Thank you.
Mr. Martinez.
That's it. Thank you. I feel better. Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Vinoy Shaw, and I am an Al-Anon.
Hi,
Vinoy. Hi, y'all. I came into this amazing fellowship of ours February the 7th of 1969. And February marked 50 years. I just still can't believe that. And I've been having parties everywhere. Instead of them coming to me and overwhelming me, I decided to go to them. So I've had one in Texas. Justin is just west, right on the fringe of Dallas. So that's where we are. If you're a race car track person, the Texas Speedway is just kind of front of my house. So some of you, I'm sure, I've heard. I had a sponsor for 40 years. Her name was Pat Clater, and she died a few years back. And then I got Nell Largent from Waurika, Oklahoma. Some of you know her, and she said to tell y'all hi. She looks real sweet. She's got this gray hair and these little purple blue lips, and she looks real sweet. But if you don't do what she tells you to do, she's just an old ordinary sponsor. And of course, I want to thank, let's see, what is your name? Jackson? Who I want to thank is his beautiful bride who puts up with him months and months and months before this and takes care of it. I know, I've been there. They can be real irritable. And the committee, I mean, y'all are just amazing. Thank you. This is just, it looks like y'all aren't fussing or fighting. I don't know if you are, it'd be a miracle, but it looks like it not. And I want to thank Don, who picked us all up. Boy, he's a hoot. We got off that plane, and two Texas women and a blonde. And I came up with all this luggage just everywhere, stack. And Joe and Tammy were sitting over there, very quiet, because they were in a coma, actually, from traveling all day long. And he looked at all that luggage, and he said, well, we can't get all that. He said, I can get y'all. And he said, y'all can do something else. And he scooped us up and left Joe and Tammy in the dust. So I believe they had to rent a car and drive themselves here. Good going, Don. And thank you, committee. It's been great. And I need to thank my BFF, Nancy. She helps mess with me, and Dana, who came with my daughter. And I think you kept saying it's kind. It's kind. Everybody's kind, and I love that, and they have been. I need to tell you this. I have vertigo. And I've had it for 2 years this month. And it messes with my head. And I may be seeing you perfectly clear, and then the room may start spinning. And then I do all kinds of weird things. And I struggle with words, and I lose my head sometimes. So y'all are in for a good ride. This is what I say. I'm going to give you, it's like having a big puzzle. I'll give you a lot of pieces, and y'all may have to kind of put them together. And I think the devil's making me say this, but I cannot help it. I do have 50 years in this program. And this program means more to me than I could ever say, ever. It saved me, and it saved my family, and it continues to save my family. And it's magnificent. And this room has been pretty much full all weekend. And this afternoon, it's about half full. It's nap time or shopping time. And those people who are out there doing that probably have a grandmother, a grandfather, a mother or a father, a brother or sister, a son or a daughter, a granddaughter or a grandson that's got a drinking problem. And they don't think they need Al-Anon. Most of them don't think they do, really. They think they've got everything they need, and that's good if it works for them. But Al-Anon only enhances. It only enhances. And you can't go to a brain surgeon to get your lawnmower fixed. And I really want to thank the speakers, Danny and Nancy, Joe. I believe you're the only speakers that are here at the Al-Anon speaker meeting. And thank you for doing that. Oh, and Tracy, you know, she had to come. Yes, you did have to. And I know some of these speakers well. And, you know, they're all of them are ex-convicts. Man, that makes my heart just go, whoo, 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 whoo. Yes. Guys, a lot of those. That's great. And it helps me to see the support. I love alcoholics. I hate alcoholism. I hate it. With every fiber of my being, I hate it. And that's why it's so important to me to be here and stay here and listen to y'all and be present and do the things that we do around here. And I'm looking forward to the other speakers. Jeff speaks tonight. And let me tell you, well, the Bismarck, North Dakota bunch aren't here, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Jeff probably is just now thawing out. Now, my daughter was at a convention, and Tom Iverster was there. He says, "Where's your mom this weekend?" And she said, "She's up in Bismarck, North Dakota." And he said, "Oh, they only get the Class B speakers in January in Bismarck." And I was up there with Jeff and his wife. And when they say it's cold, I mean, that don't do it, does it? I mean, it's not cold. It is horrible. Horrible. You can't breathe very far out of your nose. It freezes right there, right? Just freezes. You can't take a deep breath because your throat's going to be ice. And it takes them a while to thaw out. And I think Jeff is still thawing out. Watch him tonight. He'll be going. But let me tell you, they have some of the finest fun fellowship in the world and one of the best steaks I ever ate. I guess those poor old cows were running to the fire to get warm. And I have a commitment that I need to tell you before I get started. A few years ago, three or four, I was in Los Angeles. One of the people that I have sponsored for many years was having a 35th Al-Anon birthday. And a big celebration, a lot of fun. And she asked me if I would go to church with her. She had asked me many times. I had lived out there for many, many years, and I had moved back to Texas at this point. And all those times I lived there, she tried to get me to go to church with her. Well, you know, she's Catholic. And my grandmother told me about Catholics, and I couldn't play with them for some reason or another. I don't know why. Never did know why. Because we're Baptists. We're the real deal. So she asked me if I would please go with her. Okay. And several of us went, and we were going to looking for an escape plan after a bit. After she saw us, then we could leave. I had really bad knees, and that getting up and down, I was just dreading it so much. And so we had an escape plan, and the priest said, "And Corinne has visitors here today, and we will hear from all of them when the Mass is over." So we were caught. And I tell you that part because I did not want to do it. I can't tell you how many times in this program I've done something I didn't want to do. And it's been some of the biggest miracles that's ever happened in my life because I do it. I was taught when you take a commitment, you do it. So we did, we stayed, and it was afterwards, it was All Saints Day. So they pray for people that are dead and do things for them. And one of the parishioners had asked the priest if they, Los Angeles, as you can well imagine, has a lot of deaths. And they have a morgue that is just stuffed, bodies stacked on unclaimed bodies, just stuffed there. And she asked them if their church could adopt one of those unclaimed bodies. So they did that, and it took them almost a year to go through that process and get it done. And this was the Sunday that they were going to take care of that. And he said, all we know about this body is it's a young girl. She's between 22 and 24 years old. And that's all they knew. She was found literally in a gutter, dead from drugs and alcohol. So they adopted her. So after the service, they have a big foyer, and in that is a lot of little cubby holes. And they were going to put her in a, they did put her in a cubby hole, and they said prayers and whatever they do. And I looked at that. It looks like a coffee can, a silver coffee can. And I looked at that, and I was way back at the back, leaning against the wall, and I thought, her mama will never know what happened to her. Her mama will never know where she is. And I didn't start crying. I started weeping, just sorrow, weeping. And everybody was filing out, and the priest saw me and asked me to come over. He said, why don't you, you can touch her. Why don't you talk to her? And he said, her name is Margaret Berry. So I put my hand on top of that canister, and I patted it, and I just rubbed it, and I was just crying and crying. And I said, Margaret, it is written that God will put somebody to stand in the gap for you. And I'm going to do that. I'm standing in the gap for your mama. And I want you to know that I love you. And that you are forgiven for everything you ever did. And you're with some people who are going to take care of you. You're safe now. Warm and comfortable. And I will see you later. I love you. And I walked away. And I made a commitment that day. I will carry her name wherever I go, because you never know. You never know who you's going to be sitting in the audience. So Margaret Berry, rest in peace. Well, I have a plethora of alcoholics, let me tell you. if I didn't have enough that I could catch, I gave birth to a couple of them, you know. And they keep the supply going, so it's really nice. I was born in Lubbock, Texas. Go Texas Tech, Final Four. And my dad was part Indian. My mama was a high school dropout, one of four kids. Her daddy drank. My grandmother was untreated Al-Anon. My mama was an untreated Al-Anon. They met and married and had four kids, myself and three brothers. Two of those brothers, one committed suicide, alcoholic, couldn't get sober. The other one died. I'm not sure how, but I have some ideas. He broke his neck when I was a little kid. And he and his wife planted and grew and harvested marijuana in his bedroom. So he always had his own supply. And that was when they would have probably put him under a prison if they'd caught him. And so he stay pretty happy most of the time. And I felt so, my mother put me in different places while my brother was being taken care of. He did it in Oklahoma. So they had to stay in that over there with him months and months and months. So I was kind of farmed out to different people. And so I didn't fit in there. I wasn't supposed to be there. I felt out of place, and I was forever. Finally, they came home, and I got to go home. And I was a young teenager by this time. And I met some older women, you know, that's probably 16 or 17, something like that. And they took me to a place that changed my life forever, ever and ever. And it's called a West Texas honky tonk. Yeah, I heard you sighing, yeah. Yeah, it was like magic there. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, wasn't, and they were teaching me how to do. And, you know, there was a band playing real loud and a mirror ball going around, so it was flashing, so there was a lot of just boom, 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 excitement in the air. And they taught me that you watch the guys over at the bar. And about 11-ish, they'll start falling off those bar stools and head your way, so you need to kind of pick one. And that's exactly what I did. I learned real quick. And so about 11-ish, and I'd never danced in my life that I know of. And I got out there on that dance floor, and it was like second nature to me. You know, I could have won Dancing with the Stars. I could have won anything because I fell into it. And I can dance. I'm telling you, I can dance. So I figured it out pretty quick. And it's getting closing time, which is really critical. And you have to wind up with the one that you decided is going to be your forever. And I did. I captured him. And we were on the dance floor. And it was a slow song, Sleepwalk. I don't know if y'all know that here in Portland. Sleepwalk is our national anthem. Isn't that right, Danny? I mean, it just does. I mean, Sleepwalk in that steel guitar goes into your bones. It transforms you into a heaven. It's glorious. It's just totally glorious. And one of the ways that I understand my disease is this. I heard an alcoholic talking from behind this podium, which I'm going to stop right there and say something right now. I believe that this podium in this area is hallowed ground. I believe that God shows up here, God works here. This is hallowed ground. And I try to respect it with as much respect as in my body. And so did these other speakers. And there are divine appointments here. There are things. People could say one sentence up here and change my life forever. So I want you to know I respect this. However, this speaker said that he was skinny and pimply and pukey and nobody wanted to be around him. And he was kind of crazy. And then he took his first drink. And it went down into his little tummy, and then it goes boom. And then it came back and just made him have big shoulders and big arms. And boy, he was a man. Just, well, I remembered that talk when I was sitting in a meeting one day. And I flashed back to this very moment many years prior. It was the last dance. Sleepwalk was going. And I got my hymn, and this is going to be it. Oh, this is going to be it. And we're dancing, and I guess y'all dance the way we do in Texas, but when we dance, it's you almost need a room. And you put, his face was right here, just, oh, you know, just, oh. My arm's here and up here, and we are in it, just in it. And here's this song. It just takes you away, and I can do it. And he's right here nibbling. And he says, "Sugar, I need you." Oh, boom, boom, boom. That describes to you Al-Anon. Y'all take alcohol, we take the alcoholic. And I just assumed this is it. You know, we would be, oh, man, this is my man. This is it. My journey has ended. The hunt's over. And took him to my house, and I learned things that you, oh, Lord of mercy, I learned all kinds of things that night. And I knew my grandma would be very upset with me. And the next morning when I woke up, he was gone. I didn't know what that meant. So I went back out the same honky-tonk hunting him, and I never found him again. And so I just picked another one, you know, that was going to be for my forever, ever. And that seemed to kind of repeat itself. And I was like a slut puppy hoe. And one night, this gambler walked by my table, and people were afraid of this guy. He was a gangster. He was such a good gangster. God, I loved him. And exciting. And he wore a shoulder holster with his gun right here. And he walked by one time and did something I could see. Oh, he's got a gun. Oh, my God. I just... And one night he walked by and he threw a $100 bill on my table. Now, we hadn't met. He just threw that $100 bill and he said, "Here, why don't you walk around on this a while?" Well, you know, that's immediate love and relationship right there. I mean, you know, that seals it. And we did. We started having a meaningful relationship. Back then they called it, we were shacked up. I think you call it tendering or something now. Is it tendering? Is that it, tendering? I think y'all kind of spoiled. We had to go out and work for it, and y'all just... You don't learn much that way. So we were having this meaningful relationship, and all of a sudden I was pregnant. And this was in the late 50s. And you do not get pregnant unless you are married. It was the worst scandal that you could do ever. It just was not done. And my parents, God bless my parents, they were just, my daddy lost his business on my brother's broken neck and hospital bills. And you know, just it was just awful. They didn't have much in their lives at all. And they did not deserve that from me. They just didn't. But there I was. And right before my daughter was born, he came to the hospital. Excuse me, man, I'm going to sit down on this stool. There. And he came by the hospital and he said, "You know, I've gone as far with you as I can go. You're going to have to get your things and move out." Well, I was crushed. And you know where I went? To Mommy. Mommy wasn't very happy with me at all. Right after that, I got up and I got well, and I thought, I know what to do. Alcoholism, they talk about the isms. alcoholism. It's not just the alcohol, it's the isms. And my great-grand sponsor was Marcy White from Texas. And she said, you know, I've been doing some study, and then Al-Anons have isms also. And we got to studying that, and I do book studies a lot, and we'd gather up the information and made a list of our isms, and there's a lot. But one of them is, you know, control, of course, lack of humor, manipulation, all those vengefulness, just nasty stuff. Well, I decided I needed to show him how much he was going to miss me. So I got a guy from across town who was another gambler. And these were, you know, these were kind of seedy people. They weren't, well, if there could have been a mafia in Lubbock County, Texas, they would have been the mafia. They were thieves and prostitutes and pimps, and they called them boosters and drug runners. They're just the lowest of society almost. And that's where I felt comfortable with those people. I fell in there and felt comfortable. So I went over to a other part of town to get a guy that he had a lot of bad blood with, and decided I'd show him. I'd get this guy to take me where he was going, which was a place. It opened up, like Joe said, it opens up after everything else closed, and it was called the Bloody Bucket. it was a knife and gun club. If you didn't have a knife or a gun, they'd issue you one at the door. And a lot of bad things happened at that place. So I got this guy. I mixed his drinks for him, and I mixed it way too, you know, instead of half and half, it was almost full whiskey with a little bit of water. And I got him very drunk and talked him into taking me to the Bloody Bucket, because this gambler would see me with him, realize how much he needed me and loved me and wanted me, and then he'd come get me. So we did that. And somebody came up to me and said, y'all got to get out of here, and you got to get out of here right now. So we did. We scooted. I got the drunk guy. He was so drunk, God love him. Put him in the car, and we left. I think it was 2 days later, maybe three, one of my good friends knocked on my door at dawn. And I remember the sun was just coming up, and she was standing there, and she told me that the gambler had taken a shotgun and blew this man's head off. Now, I never, what? You know, that doesn't happen in real life. That's not real. And all of a sudden, the sun was going back down. I thought, how strange, because everything was getting black, and it was coming at me, and my throat was closing, and I had such a pain in my chest, I couldn't breathe. And I decided, I don't like the way I feel, and I don't know how I did it, but all of a sudden, boom, I shoved and pushed that feeling way down deep. I could not feel that feeling. And I remember saying to her, well, that was just too bad. Well, my parents found out about it, and they'd asked me to leave. They asked me not to tell. If anybody asked if I was their daughter, please tell them no. And they asked me not to come back over to the house. And I said, okay, Mama, I understood that. I understood that. They did not deserve that. It was so wrong. And I felt so bad. Well, I figured what I had to do was find a more upstanding alcoholic. So I went over to the rodeo grounds. And there, after the rodeo, there's a big slab, concrete slab, and a fence, and there's a band playing, and the cowboys lean on that side of the fence, and we lean on this side of the fence to about 11:30-ish, and then they start falling off that fence, and you come and you get them. So I like bull riders. And I got the cutest bull rider, and he was a champion bull rider. He really was a good bull rider. And he was built like a bull rider. And I fell in love with him instantly. So we started having a meaningful relationship. And one night he got an empty quart beer bottle, and I busted it over his head. He hit his knees. I ran outside. He ran outside of the bar and caught me. And he said, "You know what? I think you just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married." Now, let me tell you, married? He just said married. Now, I knew that was never in the picture for me. I knew that. I felt like a piece of garbage. And I was treated like a piece of garbage most of the time. Now, I drank in these bars with these people. And I was with the wrong kind of people. But I am not an alcoholic. I researched that when I first hit here. I have a lot of the feelings, a lot of the emotions. I do not have the allergy to the body. And so I was just like, this is, he's a better guy. So I ran out, he spun me around, and he said, "Really, do you want to get married?" I said, "Sure." So it couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 days I had that old boy married, man. I went to the justice of the peace, I got everything, took it to him, got him signed, got it notarized, got it back, got a pastor, got him beep, beep, boop, got a room, did it all. And now I'm married. This is fabulous. So we rented a little house. In my head, I'm going to make chocolate chip cookies and take them to the PTA. And he can mow the yard. And I can make curtains for the kitchen and be all, you know, married stuff. And that's exactly what we did for the first 6 days. It was wonderful. And then Charlie came by, and I didn't see him for 24 hours or so. And I remember thinking, what is wrong with me? I mean, what's wrong? I got married. I've done everything right, and I had made him bubble baths when he got in. I made him sandwiches and sent him off to work. And I was just the best of the best for that whole 6 days. And I did not know why. And I wondered that question for many years after that. There was a lot of Charlies. There was a lot of nights. I'd chase him into a bar, and they'd throw me out. You know, the floor bouncer would get me and throw me out because I'd go in there and get chairs and, you know, hit him across the head or the back or drag some, you know, blondes. There was always blondes around. They'd just been the bane of my existence forever. I'm talking about real ones. So I'd have to pull them out by the head of their hair, you know, till I just couldn't do that anymore. Now, both of these men were violent men. That gambler shot at me. He chased me with a pistol shooting. I was running backwards over cotton rows. I don't know if y'all know what that looks like, if it's big hump and then small and big. I was running backwards, and I hit the top of every one of those rows. And he got a what they call a blackjack and cut off the top of my ear. He would beat me. He threw me in moving cars, closed cars. He was mean and vicious. And I was right there with him. The cowboy turned out to be the same thing. He didn't wear a pistol, but he wore a cowboy hat, and they were the same. They were identical. And the violence was there. But this time, there was kids involved. How hideous was that? I got pregnant. I thought, surely a boy that he can, you know, be with and have rodeo with and play and do all, maybe that will settle. And it didn't. It just gave me somebody to hold in the middle of the night as I was looking out that window. I stood at that window, and it's been said, I knew the clang, clang, touch, tuck, bing, bing of his pickup. I could tell it a mile down if he was coming. And I would stand there and I would look and see how he got out of the pickup. If he got out of the pickup and there's a lot of beer cans falling, there's going to be trouble. If there was just a few, it might be all right. And I would run as fast as I can and go get in my bed, get on the far side and just cling to it and breathe heavy and just hope that he would just come in and pass out. Just hope that he wouldn't do anything. I did that night after night after night after night. One night, we had a big house, not a fancy house, just a big house. And he came in and flipped the light switch on in the front of the house. I was in the back of the house, in bed, sound asleep. And one of the biggest first miracles of Al-Anon is I could sleep all night. Whether he was there or whether he wasn't, I could sleep all night. And he came, flipped that light on, and he came a charging back there and jumped in that bed and started beating me up. Just beating me and beating me, and I was trying to get out of that bed and flipped on the over the side, and I looked up, and there was my two kids in the door, and both of them were just dancing, screaming, "Daddy, don't hit her anymore. Daddy, don't hit her anymore." But that night, I knew what to do. I knew what to do that night. Because about 5 years prior to that, I was done. I was so done. I had two black eyes and busted lip from a fight the previous week. He worked out of town and he was coming in on a Friday, and this was Thursday. And I knew I could not do this anymore. It's like every speaker has said, there was a click. And I wished I knew what that click was. But there was a click. I cannot do this anymore. I can't. I couldn't hardly eat. And I remembered Ann Landers. I read it every, I don't know if y'all remember, if she's still alive or doing whatever. And there was a letter in there from a woman was talking about her drunk husband, and she did not know what to do. And Ann Landers told her to go, I thought, and call Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I did. I called Alcoholics Anonymous and talked to a man, and he gave me another number, and a woman answered. And I talked to her for a few minutes, and she asked me to come to her house. I was to find out she was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous of many years. Her husband came in shortly thereafter, and he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they didn't poo-poo me off because I was just an Al-Anon. They sat there and talked to me for a couple hours. They told me their stories. They told me the things that would help me and could help me and made me some promises and gave me some things to do. And they picked me up in a few nights and took me to my first meeting. We pulled up to this little clubhouse, and I got out of the car and headed for the clubhouse door. And this man came, and he got to the door first, and he opened the door and stood there. And I thought, what's he doing? Why didn't he go in? But he was standing there looking at me. And I just stood there, what? And finally he gestured, go in. And I thought, oh my gosh, he has mistaken me for a lady. I was just stunned. I'd been watching, you know, Rock Hudson and Doris Day, and he did things for her like that. And I thought, my God, he thinks I'm a lady. And I walked over that threshold into my very first encounter with recovery. And there was two guys in, at the end of this long coffee room. And they were both leaning over a cigarette machine. And I don't know, some of you remember this. There was little packages of different brands of cigarettes on it. And you put a quarter in there and pull this knob and that pack would come out. Well, it was all different colors. And they were standing there, and the lights coming up from that was just unbelievable. And their faces looked beautiful, just beautiful. And they started laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing. It's the first time I'd heard laughter in so long. I can't even tell you. I was just mesmerized by it. She went in and sat with me at my first Al-Anon meeting. She didn't want me to be in there by myself. And I know how that feels. And I always try to find the newcomer and tell them to sit by me. I got a sponsor. Or rather, she captured me. I'd try to sneak out of that room every night, but they caught me. And she became my sponsor. She had had me over to her house, and she bought me a big book and a brand spanking new book called One Day at a Time. And she started helping me with the disease of alcoholism. Her husband, Jack, he talked to me for hours and hours about the disease of alcoholism. They pointed me the way. We went through that book first to see what alcoholism was like. And then we went back and just inserted in my mind Al-Anon, or controlling instead of drinking. And I saw the similarities to our diseases. And I did go through those steps. I didn't believe in God at all. Not at all. The Baptist folks were, they're a little strange, you know. And my grandmother's flipping. And I just knew I was so bad that God would never have anything to do with me. I'd already screwed all that up. But I found out through the steps and through going to conventions like this. The first one that came up, they told me to get in a car. And I've been doing it ever since. And the magic happens. The music happens here. I'll tell you, there's so much music here, it's blinding. And I want to welcome you if you're new. And I want you to know that Al-Anon meetings are great, but you have to also go to a committed AA meeting every week if you want to get the idea. If you want to learn what alcoholism is, you go to open AA meeting and listen to those stories, because that's where I found out my husband was an alcoholic. And when he came and did that two black eyes and busted lips, I had to leave. So I left and divorced him. That is really hard, because I loved him. I did. I loved him. But I couldn't do that. I just couldn't. So I was single in AA and started running around. And what time did I start? 10 till? What? 2:10? I started at 2:10. Oh, thank goodness. It scared me to death. If you're bored, y'all can go ahead and get up and leave. I got some more time. I'm happy. I mean, how can you get 50 years in this? I mean, how can you do it? You can't. So just pick and choose some things. But I want to tell you something. I wouldn't go anywhere else or do anything else that I'm doing right here. I am so dizzy up here that I'm just grabbing on, holding to this. But you know, I'd be dizzy if I was sitting at home. You know? They got wheelchairs to take me wherever I need to go, and I got people that are pushing each other out of the way trying to help me over here. So, you know, I love being here. And I learned here from you and the alcoholics what the disease of alcoholism is and what the Al-Anonisms are. And I am content today with myself most of the time. And I finally did divorce him, and I was running around single, and I found that I had a friend of mine. I was sitting by him, and this guy from California came in. We were at Midland at the Midwinter Conference on the second row, and this guy came in from California and put his hand across that and shook his friend's hand, then shook my hand. And I said, hello. He had this real deep voice and gray temples and big diamonds on both hands. Oh, wow. They got my attention. Julie might not like that stuff, but man, I still like it. You know, I'd rather have it than not in the program or out of the program. Give me those diamonds. I'm okay with it, you know. And so we started an Al-Anon romance. Went along for a little while. I was going to move to California where he was, and he got to be a coward. Let me tell you, single women, alcoholics are biggest cowards in the world. They are. They won't commit to a relationship for nothing. You have to not be manipulative, but you got to be smart to catch one. And he dumped me right at the last minute. And I mean, I was so angry at God, I could not believe it. Why would you give me this and then take it away? Why? I've done everything you've asked me to do, everything. I've worked the steps. I've been DRGR. I've taken out the trash. I've made the coffee. I've set up everything. I've done it. I've sponsored these sicko people of yours, you know. Why would you do this to me? And I was angry. I wasn't mad at Jim. I was angry at God. I was. And I'd go down to the AA club, and I wouldn't tell y'all this part, but my sponsor said I had to. If she'd roll over in the grave, she'd find some way to haunt me if I quit. I thought about quit telling it, but anyway, I started 13-stepping two different guys, new people. I'll show you, God. I can get the alcoholics. Yeah, I can get to them. And I went to a conference, Lakeside, Brownwood, and I was sitting next to my sponsor, and the director of the camp came in and gave a piece of paper to me. I opened it up, had a name and telephone number, said, call me. Well, my sponsor looked over and saw that, and she knew what that name was, and she knew what this meant, and she knew what I was doing, and she took me outside. Have you ever had your skin taken off with a potato peeler? And I said, she asked, what are you doing? And I said, well, Pat, God just betrayed me. He betrayed me. Why would he do this? And she looked at me and cocked her little head. She had an eyebrow that she had a disease that ate up her bones. And she had this one bone that would look at you like this. Just, and it'd scare me. I mean, I scared of her. She was this, truly, she's this size. I scared of her. She gave me that bone look. She said, hey, do you think you've ever betrayed God? And all of a sudden, I saw myself. All of a sudden, I came in front of me. And I started crying and crying and crying. I said, Pat, there's one thing about me that I have never told you, I've never told anybody, but this is the truth. I am unlovable, and I don't know why. I've tried everything. I've done everything. I've worked so hard in this program. I've done everything God's asked me, but I'm unlovable. That's why he left. I'm just unlovable. And she said, that's not so, because I love you with all your warts. And if I can do that, can you imagine how God does? I heard that. I heard that. And I took it, and I've lived with that all this time. From that day to this, you ask me to do anything in this program, and my answer is yes, I will do it. I will do it. I will do it. I will never catch up. There's not a time to catch up. But I will do it. And I started doing other different things and running around doing recovery. And Jim came back to the midwinter because he was moving to Oklahoma. And this time I caught him. And we got married. And I moved to Oklahoma with him. He brought two kids, Sheila and Jimmy. So now I had four kids that were all crazy and goons. And we started a life. And working hard to put it together. We were a recovery home. I just didn't know. I thought once you were married and went to meetings, everything's fine. Y'all look fine when y'all come in, and y'all look fine when you left. I didn't know about the car ride to and from. So we hashed out a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff. Wound up going back to California where he had been for so many years. My daughter, I went back to Lubbock to a hometown up at the Plains Convention. My daughter was there, and after a speaker, it was a priest. That's what just fascinates me. It was a priest who told her story. And she took a red rose, I think it was, or a chip or something. Anyway, she said she is an alcoholic. So, of course, I was thrilled, just thrilled to death. And we're still living in Oklahoma, and she's living in Lubbock. She did what she's supposed to. And we moved from there, from Oklahoma, shortly because of business problems, back to California. And she came there. She did, in that meantime, she said, I've got something to tell you, Mom. Well, who wants to hear that? You know, really. And she was pregnant. Well, I was kind of thrilled. You know, she's getting older, and I wanted a grandbaby. But she'd met a man on AA campus, and they got into a meaningful relationship, and I got my granddaughter, Chardae. Sheila, my stepdaughter, got sober. They got sober about the same time. She had a son, so I've got a grandson, Brad, both alcoholics and drug abusers. But we went back out there and started putting a life together, and it was great. We had a great time. And he, Jim, come in one day, and his shoulder was hurting him, and we found out he had cancer. And he was dead in 3 months. And it was such, and I found out that we'd been embezzled. So I had lost a business, I lost my husband, lost my home, lost everything. It was devastating. And I stayed out there for as long as I could in California. And Tracy got 10 years of sobriety, and she drank. And I thought she'd never be back. You get 10 years and you're gone forever. Sheila got sober. She stayed sober. She's still sober today. She has other problems, I'll tell you. Gambling is one of the worst. That's worse than drinking, I think. You know, there's always everybody gets mad when you say that, I think, or a lot of alcoholics. But when you get sober, Jim started eating chocolate bars, and he'd hide Snickers every place. And, you know, and he fought that. He loved butter, pecan, something, ice cream. And I knew he'd go on a binge when he'd sneak in and put some ice cream. And then there's the porn. I've had several people that, you know, their husbands are deep into porn. They're sober, doing sober lives, and then the gambling. And it's amazing. I have to stand here and stay in my program. It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. I have to stand here and stay. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I forgot where I was. Jason, you're on thin ice. Anyway, and then they have gotten back on track. Now I've got two grandkids, and I'll tell you briefly about them. Brad, Sheila's boy, he was our first grandson, and we just adored him, just absolutely adored him. We helped raise him for 5 years. He's just adorable and precious, and it was our second chance. Jim's especially. He was a rotten father, and he would admit it in a heartbeat. But he got a second chance with grandkids. He was crazy about Brad, and he was crazy about Chardae. He bought Santa Claus suits and would go down in the school and be Santa Claus, and he bought pumpkin stuff, and he'd go down there and be pumpkins and the Easter Bunny, whatever they need. He made up with his grandkids, and he just loved it. And then Brad, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old, he got off running, drinking and mainly using. And I didn't see him for years. He'd get sober for a few months, and then he'd be gone. I got a call when I was still living in San Jose. He was in a hospital. They was afraid he was going to die. His blood was all messed up and had septicemia, and he was just going to die. And Sheila was asking me if I'd get somebody from AA to go see him. And I said, no, Sheila, so many men have gone down there, and he's always blown them off. I'll get your brother. Your brother can go. He knows what to do. So he went down to see him, and he saw him for a couple of days. And he went up there, and Brad was going, you know, leaving without, you know, the doctor's permission. And Jimmy got him and took him, and he said, I did call Clancy. Clancy had a bed for him. He said, get him over here, and we'll take him. And so I had it set up for him. And Jimmy drove him to this one spot, and he said, "Let me take me here, and I'll call Clancy tomorrow. I've got to get some things taken care of." So Jimmy let him out, and he turned around, and he looked in his rearview mirror. Now, Brad could have turned left and got on the bus to go to his girlfriend and call Clancy. He could have turned right and gone to the drug park where the druggies lived. And as he looked into the rearview mirror, he saw this young kid, head full of dreadlocks, put his arm around my blonde-headed son, and they took off to the park. So I knew he was gone. We'd find out he was in jail, all beat up, and they'd take him from the jail to the hospital. And I just couldn't. The last time I saw him in his drinking days, I said, I cannot see you. I cannot have news about you. I love you, but I can't do this. It's killing me." So I had no contact with him. He was sleeping in a bush in South Central LA. South Central LA is the worst crime area in the United States. He said, "I'd sleep in that bush." He said, "The other day I was trying to blend in." He was blonde as he could be. And he was sleeping in there to hide so nobody would stab him in the middle of the night. He made his way back to Oklahoma. He got in some serious trouble there and was on his way to jail. Prison, federal prison for, I think it was 20 years. He was going to sign a paper in front of the court to go. He made a deal. He almost killed his girlfriend. And a man came in and said, "Judge," who he knew the judge, he knew the ADA. He said, "Let me have him." So they gave him to this man. And my grandson just celebrated 4 years of sobriety. He met a girl on AA Camas. They're married. They've got a little baby. He's just bought a house. He's got a beautiful job. If he can do it, I'm telling you, I was waiting for the phone call. He's dead. That's all. That was the next thing. Just, we got to bury him. He, thinking with him, saves my sanity. Because I've got a granddaughter that's in the middle of it right now. And Joe, I told you, you gave me a huge peace. These last 3 weeks have been mortal hell. Losing babies is not what I want to do. I don't want to see CPS take a child away. I can't do that. Sorry. And you said you were looking down at this newborn and you were going to do everything to take care of that kid, and you meant it, and you were going to do it. And I believe you. And I believe this little baby's daddy, who was tried to stay sober for 3 days, he was holding that baby. He was trying to stay sober, and he couldn't. Security took him out of that hospital. He was banned from the hospital. I hate alcoholism. It's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. But I think of Brad. He made it. God picked him up and made him. Why do I think God's not going to help Sharday? I don't know. But it gets right here and just chokes me to death. I just worship her. She's just the sweetest little thing. She's had a tough time her whole life. And here we are with babies, losing them right and left. It's just God awful. I could not exist. I could not breathe in out without y'all. I think it's been said. I come here and everything is, you know, I sat down and I needed you this weekend, probably worse than I needed any place in a long, long time. It's just been one thing after another. It's just been hammered. I got this vertigo, and I was out for 10 months, and I happened to have a ticket pre-bought quite some time ago for Puerto Vallarta, so I thought I better keep that commitment. So a girl went with me, and we went to Puerto Vallarta, my first time out in 10 months, and I went in early to set where I'm sitting. I was sitting there, and just a few people were coming in, and then a few more, and Mari from Canada was sitting next to me, And I wasn't saying anything, and tears just started coming down my eyes. And she leaned over and she said, "Are you hearing the music?" And I said, "Yes. You're my soothing music. You are what puts my soul back together. You help me keep my sanity together. I know there's hope here. And I know that it's going to be all right. No matter what happens, it's going to be all right. I think I'll go home and pray about it and then call you back, Joe, and tell you what happened." I made a commitment to a man named Bob White many, 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 many years ago. He talked at the Canyon Conference Jim and I started, first one. And he said this at Sunday morning. And I saw him a few weeks later, right after he left there, he found out he had cancer. And he just lived a few short weeks or months, and then he died. But I'd gone off to talk, and I came back by there and was talking to him. He lived in Lake Whitney, Texas. And I said, "I told your story this morning." He said, "Make a commitment to me, please, that you will always tell it. It's very important." And I said, "I will. I commit." And this is what he said that Sunday morning. He said, "We close every meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And it starts off with our Father. And then it has a line in there, 'The kingdom and the power and the glory forever.' Any school kid," said he, "could figure out if there's a king and he's our father, that makes us a prince and a princess. We're royalty. We need to act like royalty, treat each other like royalty. And the kingdom is right here. This is the kingdom. And the power is these stories and sitting in a chair and picking up a coffee cup and smiling and somebody taking my gift at the raffle and just stuff like, you know, it's just little stuff that we do." He didn't say that. I put that in. "And the glory is God Himself. God is here. He's always here. Sometimes I can feel it very strongly and sometimes I can't, but He's always here. So I know who I am. I know what I'm supposed to do and how to do it. I am Princess Vinoy. I am a child of the King. And thank y'all for my legacy."